This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
Fancy little slice of heaven this afternoon. Well, a little while ago I took a trip to New Zealand. Some of you might remember I brought you that program back in June. Today, we're on repeat. It's that time that I bring you that chat again. For those of you who did miss it, you're going to hear from winemaker Alan Peters Oswald, another winemaker by the name of Peter Jackson, and his viticulturalist Fraser. You're going to meet the team from the winery in Queenstown, and you're going to meet an incredible young chef by the name of Bradley Hornby, whose work I'm enamoured by. All of that is coming up between now and 2 o'clock right here on Cravings on Joy 94.9. Stay tuned, we shall enjoy ourselves.
Our first word today is cravings. Cravings. We're talking cravings.
We are indeed talking cravings, and we are craving more of New Zealand. I did bring you a show back in June, so a couple of months ago now, 6 weeks maybe. We're going to revisit that program, and you're going to meet again Alan Peters Oswald, Peter Jackson, and Fraser from Catalina. You're going to meet the team at the winery, and you're also going to meet a brilliant young chef, as mentioned just now, Bradley Hornby. He is from a place called Arbor, just outside of Blenheim in the Marlborough region in New Zealand. It's such a beautiful place, and I keep going back and having these memories of this trip, so I'm going to share that with you again. If you have heard it before, perhaps you can take the day off cravings. I'd rather you didn't, but you might have missed something in the first show that you'll pick up today. So I do thank you for your company. I look forward to sharing with you the next hour before the Escape Pod take you travelling at 2 o'clock. You are on Joy 94.9. My name is Peter Dillon. This is Cravings, and let me introduce you to Alan Peters Oswald. I'm standing in the middle of a vineyard in central Otago. It's about -3 degrees, so if my teeth chatter, you'll forgive me. I'm with winemaker Alan Peters Oswald. He's from Nanny Goat and Super Nanny. Welcome.
Hi, how are you going?
This is it looks like a very barren, very stark sort of landscape we're in. It's misty, it's cold, the vines are all dormant. How does this change as the season evolves?
Central Otago is always very barren and dry, and I think that's part of the beauty of Central Otago. It's rugged, it's really hard to get anything to grow here, so it's a struggle to get the vines to perform well. They crop very lightly, but that in turn produces intensely flavoured fruit, and with good colour and good flavour. So the whole barren nature of the land reflects in the final product. It's hard work, but it's very worthwhile in the end.
So known for Pinot Noir, a little bit of Chardonnay. What else is sort of grown in the area?
Central Otago, obviously predominantly Pinot Noir, also grows white varietals very well. Chardonnay, Riesling, Pinot Gris all do very well here. But Central Otago has certainly built its name on Pinot Noir production.
Let's talk a little bit about how you came to wine, because from my understanding, you started as a viticulturalist, somebody who sort of tends to the growing and the management of the vines rather than the production of wine from the grapes.
That's correct, yeah. I left school and Central Otago was booming with grape plantings, and it really captured my attention. And that's something that I really strive to work towards, a lifestyle working in the vines. I moved away to study, and along the lines I got sidetracked by the fun and the excitement and the intensity of working in a winery. So I shifted my focus to winemaking, and I've never looked back since.
Well, I imagine there's a great deal of joy in a finished product in the bottle. We looked at a range of the Nanny Goat and the Super Nanny Pinot Noirs last night. Is that you know, you see them come off the bottling line at the end of production? Is that sort of a big sigh of relief to know you've got something in the bottle that's of some quality?
Yeah, absolutely, it is. But it's also great to see how the individual parcels of wine progress throughout the winemaking process. You know, we try to keep everything separate and let every piece of land tell its own story, and then put them all together in the end like a big jigsaw puzzle. So it is very satisfying to see that puzzle come together and tell a tale of all the individual parcels.
I imagine that it's I talked to before about it being quite barren and you know, it really is misty and cold. How much intervention takes place when you're producing wines of the quality we find from Central Otago?
I think a lot of producers are moving towards a less interventional process, you know, obviously trying to let those individual parcels speak. You know, the key to making a good wine is showing off the part of land that they're from. And, you know, certainly speaking for myself, I'm moving towards less intervention, less new oak use. I don't want to cloud that beautiful fruit with too much intervention. So, you know, moving towards natural fermentation and doing everything I can possible to allow those parcels to shine.
Alan Peters Oswald is my guest. He's the winemaker for Nanny Goat and Super Nanny. We're quite literally standing in the mist in the middle of Central Otago. It's -3 or -4 degrees. I don't know what it is. All I know is that every part of my body is clenched. How do the vines? So we're looking at them now. If I look over the back, there's some people in amongst the mist pruning the vines, getting them ready to sort of stay dormant through winter before the spring bud burst. How dormant do they become? Do they still sort of draw moisture and nutrients, or what's there in the earth?
No, at the moment they're dormant. They're not doing anything, so there's no sap flowing. So they're protected from the cold. It allows us to prune them and not damage things. Luckily, we don't get so cold that the vines do die. I believe you get to -20 or thereabouts and the vines literally die. So we're lucky in the fact that we don't quite get that cold. But they're certainly in a good state at the moment, being asleep throughout the winter.
And how do you manage pest control? Because I imagine there are some natural predators, if you will, or natural pests that like grapevines. So how is that managed? Is it done with sheep and goats and things?
There's probably not a great deal of natural pests in Central Otago. Probably the biggest threat would be rabbits nibbling at the vines and trying to get moisture from them. But
how keep those little buggers out?
Most vineyards are fenced. Mm-hmm. Some people shoot them. You know, there's no natural predators here to keep them in check. So, shooting the rabbits or just trying to keep them out by natural means or by fencing.
Coming through the travelling here to get to this particular vineyard, there were some wild goats on the hill. Tell us about how the name Nanny Goat and Super Nanny came to be.
So the Nanny Goat vineyard name came to be in around 2005. We produced our first vintage in 2005. So the owner of the company was in Queenstown looking to go up the Skyline Restaurant, which is a beautiful restaurant up the top of a hill and overlooking Queenstown. However, he wasn't a great fan of heights and chose to walk the path rather than take the gondola up the hill. But not being one to really take direction or you know, listen to people's advice, he forged his own trail through the hillside and came unstuck and found himself stranded on a rocky outcrop, like an old nanny goat, as he put it. But Nanny Goat Vineyard is also a fair reflection on the nature of the land in Central Otago. It's very mountainous and sort of mountain goat country, and the vineyards are placed fairly precariously in places. So you know, it's a fair reflection on the landscape of the region.
Well, Alan, it's good to talk to you. We need to go inside and get warm and have a glass of Pinot Noir. This is ridiculous being in this cold. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I've missed my favourite show on Joy. What do I do? What do I do?
Podcasters to battle!
Joy podcasters fight on tirelessly to bring you the best bits of every show. So if you've missed something recently on Joy, don't worry. Our podcasters have your back. Head to joy.org.au and click on the podcast tab or look us up on iTunes. Podcasters on Joy 94.9, fighting tirelessly for your listening pleasure.
Standing in the middle of the Marlborough region in the northern part of New Zealand, South Island, it is one of the most spectacular wine-producing regions in New Zealand, and I have both a winemaker and a viticulturalist here to tell me about this part of the world. I'm going to start with you, Fraser, the viticulturist. Tell me about growing grapes in this region.
Oh, it's a fantastic region to grow grapes. We have the perfect summers. You get lots of regular rainfall, but yet at the same time it's nice and dry. Have great soils. This site especially has got a mix of alluvial soils and then clay hillsides, so we can really select different areas for different varieties. So the Pinot's on the clays, Chardonnay in the clay, and then the Sauvignon's down on the alluvial, more free-draining soils.
And most people would know the region for the great proliferation of Sauvignon Blanc in Australia, but it's becoming quite known for other varietals as well.
Yes, yeah, as I said, the Pinot's in the clay soils, I think they're really starting to come on, coming into age now. There's a lot of Pinot's that are planted down on the flats. People are finding these nice clay hillsides that really suit the Pinot's. Good moisture-holding capacities in the clay, so it shows through into the grapes.
Peter Jackson is the winemaker who probably has one of the coolest names in New Zealand. I imagine they love you over here, Pete. How much do you inform Fraser about what you want from the vines?
Very little, actually. Fraser and I started together more or less 5 years ago. And since day one, it's been pretty obvious that Fraser's got a very keen, attentive eye to detail. And so we're more or less on the same page the whole time. I think, I can't really ask any more of my vineyard manager, viticulturist, to just be over the top of everything, know where crops are sitting, know where disease pressure might be. And Fraser, I mean, of all the people that I've worked with in vineyards, Fraser would be top of the list for attention to detail.
So you're a boy from Ipswich in Queensland. How did you come to be in this region of the world?
Well, it's a bit of a story. I actually think it goes back to my first year at high school when I wanted to study Japanese as my second language. A lot of other people did as well, so I got thrown into French class. And from there, I went through a few years of French, actually grew to like it, continued on right to the end of high school. During that time, I did a bit of a homestay over in France for 6 weeks, which furthered my interest in it. And then post-high school, I went and did an arts law degree where I majored in French at university. And 2 years into that, I took a year off, flew to France, bought a bike, and just rode a bike around for 12 months. So that, I had no interest in wine when I left, but riding a bike around for that long inevitably took me through a lot of wine regions. I met people, just about everyone in France has got some sort of association to wine. And I really found myself becoming very interested in the history and the tradition of wine particularly. So when I got back to Australia, I persevered with the arts law for a while, finished my arts degree, and knew that I never wanted to be a lawyer. And when I thought about it, I thought, well, very naively, that the wine game seemed pretty interesting. And with that, I applied to do the course in Adelaide and got in and moved down there, and that's how it all started. Oh, but getting over to here was actually another connection from Adelaide, a person I lived with there. Their sibling and husband bought a small winery over here, having been in the Clare Valley at the time, and they rang me up one day out of the blue and said, "Do you want to come work a vintage?" I said, yeah. I was always keen to get over to New Zealand. This provided the opportunity, came, loved it. The climate really spoke to me. I'd never been to a place around the world that I thought had a climate so ideally suited for growing grapes. And then the opportunity came to stay permanently from then on, and I grabbed that.
So you've been here, what, 10 years?
Yeah, a little over 10 years permanently now.
Do they still see you as an interloper, an Australian winemaker in Marlborough in New Zealand, or are you has that novelty worn off a bit?
I think despite being from Queensland, I'm told my accent isn't that broad. And so not too many. I mean, talking to me, probably a lot of people wouldn't know that I'm Australian. So I don't get asked that question too much. But for those who do, no, I think I'm treated as part of the wine community here. There's an awful lot of Australians here, mind you, in the wine industry here. Yes, as there are a lot of New Zealanders in the Australian wine industry.
Fraser, listening to your accent and listening to his, they are remarkably different, I think. So he doesn't sound like a Kiwi at all in my mind. He also doesn't sound like a Queenslander. What's the benefit of him bringing that knowledge of what he discovered in France and elsewhere in New Zealand to this particular place where you are? Has he got something that works with your ideology or your philosophy?
I think Pete and I both work well together. We've had the same ideas. And as he said, he doesn't ask too much of me, and I think we work well together, so we've got the same ideas.
Tell me about, you've got two native New Zealand pigs over here, and I know they're natives because I can't find them in Australia. They're called Kuni Kuni pigs. Tell me about these little pigs. What's their contribution to what you guys do?
Oh, I just bought them as pets for my son. I got them here, and within a week he didn't like them because they were too noisy. But I let them out to roam around the vineyard, and one day I was driving along the tractor and I noticed them chewing off the shoots on the bottom of the vines, which is a very labour-intensive job for us to do. So I thought, hey, if these pigs can do it, we need to get a few more on board and train them up and get them to do the work for us.
So you still only have the two?
Yes, only two. I think any more would be a bit of a handful. As I say, they get fairly noisy. Mm.
So I want to try and give a bit of an idea of the setting here. It's certainly much more temperate than it was in our last stop in central Otago, where it was bloody freezing. Paint a picture of Pete, where we are, so that listeners can get an understanding of what, you know, we're standing here looking at mountains and acres of grapevines. Talk us through what the topography is like and what it's like to be in this space.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I love about Marlborough is its position in that it's protected in three different directions. From to the north of us, where we're looking, we've got the Richmond Ranges, which provides protection for us from the weather that comes in from the north. Running up the spine of the South Island, we have the Southern Alps, which tends to stall all the weather fronts that come over from the west coast. They hit the Alps, and we might get a little bit of spillover, but that's it. The southerly extremes that push up the country, they fly up the country, they tend to hit Kaikoura and head over to Wellington. So we're in this really lovely, protected little top corner of New Zealand. It is largely flat. I mean, the plains around here are dead flat. But where we're positioned here is we're starting to get into the foothills of some of the ranges, the Waihopai ranges behind us. And that's something that we're seeing more and more, the exploitation of these hillsides, these foothills that lead up into the higher hills. For a long time, you know, the vast majority of plantings were just on that valley floor, and that's well suited to Sauvignon Blanc. But more and more, we're seeing this development of vineyard into the foothills, hillside vineyards, and particularly that's where we're seeing the real progress with varieties like Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and I think even Pinot Gris goes really well on those clay soils. But yeah, generally speaking, it is. I mean, the valleys, as you've seen, they're quite flat, river terraces, but then some steep inclines into the surrounding mountains, which provide great shelter for the region generally.
We're just up at the top of the property, sort of looking out, and you told me that the ocean is only 10 kilometres away.
From Blenheim.
From Blenheim, so yeah, 20-odd k's from here.
Yeah. Something like that, yes. Yeah.
How much does that affect or become part of a maritime climate? Do you get any benefits from being close to the ocean? And I'll talk about the vines themselves. Fraser?
Yes, in the summers we do get nice warm breezes that come through in the afternoons. They really help to dry out the vines if we have mornings where there's a heavy dew. We do get that nice drying wind in the afternoon, and then at the same time in the afternoons when that warm breeze starts to blow back out to the sea, we get the cooler winds coming off the higher mountains at the back. So we do get a big temperature range, warm days and then the cooler nights, which really help out.
And your harvest is much later, or your vintage is much later than Australia by a month or two. So still seeing grapes on the vines as you're going into pruning, I think we'd find most of our close regions in Victoria are already pruned and almost dormant. So with that slightly later season, does that mean that your wines release into market later?
Not necessarily. I mean,
Yeah, I mean, I guess we would be harvesting at a similar time to, say, Tasmania, so late March through April. As to when that dictates the release of the wine, that you know, there are plenty of places bottling in June, July. So it really just comes down to your product and your market requirements as to how quickly you need to get it out there. Personally, I have a real preference for trying to give the wines as much time as possible. So the Sauvignons, I tend to leave on lees unsulfured for a good 2-3 months before we start prepping them for bottling. And I think that builds texture and builds more interest into the wine. And that's something that I think is really important for our style.
What is it about here that you love? Because are you from this particular area? Are you from Melbourne, Fraser?
From Nelson, so about an hour and a half away. I was in the vineyards over there, but then decided to move over this side, where obviously there's a lot more vineyards. And I live on site. It's an absolute great location. I've got two little boys that live here. And
I imagine they get to run around and chase chooks. And
they do, yeah. Mm. Chase the pigs and the pigs chase them. And yeah. Where we are on this vineyard in particular, it's a really awesome site. We've got great views looking down the valley and out in the country. It's nice.
It's quite stunning. Guys, thank you. Continued success.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
The winery has been operating for 11 years. We are one of the largest wine tasting experiences of the world using the Enomatic wine system. It allows us to open here over 93 different wines, whiskies and champagnes. We specialise in New Zealand's finest wines and cover all the main varietals and look to present the best of New Zealand to visitors to Queenstown. The Enomatic system allows us to preserve wines that are open, keeps them fresh for an extended period of time, and customers use a smart card system to self-serve themselves. The system allows them to serve them either a taste or a half glass or a full glass of the various wines. It'd be fair to say with so many wines, about 80% of the volume that we serve is actually done by tasting. So customers have the opportunity to try a little portion of wines that they may never get to try and try before they buy, I guess. It's been a long journey, like many things. We've been here 11 years and, it's... we're now, the number one thing in TripAdvisor to do as an activity in central Queenstown. Number 8 of things to do overall, including all the activities of the region. So I suppose that we've grown to be sort of a destination point for people who are interested in wine. Hopefully a must-do experience. I first came across the Enomatic system in Tuscany in 2002, and it turned out that was actually the first place it was where I discovered it had been created. And prior to leaving there, I actually signed up the distribution rights for Enomatic for Asia Pacific, and then set about coming back to Queenstown and creating this business as a standalone business, a business in its own right, as a wine tasting experience for Central Otago initially, but it's sort of expanded to be the best of New Zealand. The system uses argon, high purity argon gas, which is the same gas that winemakers use in the winemaking process, food grade high purity argon. Often nitrogen is also used. The benefit of argon gas is it is heavier than air, and so it actually blankets over the wine, and it does dissolve slightly less into the liquid than nitrogen gas does, but both are inert gas, mean they have no flavour, taste, aroma, and that therefore keeps the oxygen from coming into contact with the wine. And through that process, we can keep the wines fresh in excess of 2 weeks. But of course, when we're busy, the wine is never in the system for that sort of period of time. But it does allow us to open products like Penfolds Grange, which moves a bit more slowly, but we do go through a lot of that product as well.
I must say, I've never seen Penfolds Grange where you can buy just a nip like that, ever.
Yeah, look, there's a few sites across Australia now. We do quite a bit of work with Treasury Wine Estates in the Enomatic business, and it does create that opportunity. When same in our champagne machine, we can open Dom Perignon and Krug and Runart and some better quality wines. And so what we do here is we give people the opportunity to try things that they might not normally try ever find by the glass. anywhere. Have a little taste, as you say. The Grange is a good example of that, but plenty of examples across New Zealand's better reds that don't get to that sort of price point, but get up there, and reserve Pinot Noirs, and it gives us the opportunity to create some experiences. But also for our business, it's about leading people to things they enjoy and wines that they prefer. And typically you find that although price isn't always a guide to quality, it does allow people to de-risk their purchase from a retail perspective by tasting it before they take the bottle from the shelf. Here, Pinot Noir is we have 24 of those for tasting, and that's really what Central Otago obviously is becoming world famous for, followed by Sauvignon Blanc in terms of consumption. I'm talking here, people, you know, want to try those wines. They expect us to always have Cloudy Bay, but there's many good Sauvignon Blancs as well, but Pinot Noir is probably the focal point for the store here. I enjoy my Pinots, of course. I also enjoy Riesling, and I prefer them with some sugar, some residual sweetness. I really enjoy those sorts of wines. And I'm still not a person who can articulate 25 cherry aromas from a Pinot Noir, but I can tell whether I like it or I don't like it, and then I can, you know, assess things side by side, and that's, I guess, what we offer here. Rather than perhaps travelling between wineries, you can put the glasses side by side of whatever you've got in your hand, and you can compare them, you know, face-to-face, effectively. The cost, as much or as little as you wish to do, really. So the tasting portion and the half glass and the full glass portion are all related to the value of the wine. So the more expensive the product, then the more it's going to cost to taste. The average card spend here the average card spend is about $30 to $35. Often that's shared between a couple of people, as a couple, but people can spend as much or as little as they want. If you wanted to drink Penfolds Grange for the afternoon, then you would certainly rack up more of a bill. If you enjoyed reserve Pinot Noirs, then likewise. But really, for $20, you can come and have a very good experience and try some very nice wines. We have two peak seasons, ski season, which we're starting to move into, and then the summer season. In between, it's pretty quiet, like it is now here in Queenstown. Well, one measure is the number of cheese boards we've been doing, I guess. Well, there's some number I do know. We've done about 3,500 of those in the last year. I guess we probably, at peak times... I need to look at that. But we certainly get, some days it's not big enough, the space, other days it's too big, and at peak times we get slammed a little bit, but we manage. It's actually converting. This was one of the very first installations of the Enomatic system in the world, and at the time we set it up with just one volume buttons on the machines, and the machine you refer to is a round one. It wasn't so easy to convert that over from one volume to three volumes. So about 2.5 years after we opened, we converted all the other machines to three volumes so we could do the taste, half glass, full glass. Although, as I said, a lot of the volume is still predominantly by the taste. But what I've done there is I've just taken an old machine that we've secured and transplanted the head unit of it, which now makes it a three-volume machine. So that machine contains our New Zealand reds, a lot of Waiheke, Hawke's Bay reds, Cabernet, Merlot, and often people do want to take a half glass and a full glass of those. So some of the staff have been pushing me for some time, and the opportunity came along. So some technical work this afternoon.
What's your background? Where did you come from?
Actually, project management and construction and architecture.
So what brought you to this sort of environment?
We enjoyed wine. My wife and I, we were on our last trip before children, we thought. She'd fallen pregnant, it turned out, and we had just done our last trip to Europe. We'd flown into Frankfurt, and we came down the Moselle and Alsace and into Tuscany, and that's where I came across the Enomatic system. Sitting by the pool the day after I'd enjoyed plenty of good wines. I walked into the space. There was 140 of Italy's best wines that you could try. I had a sober driver, and so I took advantage of that. The next day, sitting by the pool, I was thinking, yeah, it's a pretty interesting concept. You know, in Italy, it's not the sort of place that you can go to cellar doors and be welcomed, and they're ready to, you know, to sample their wines. So the only place that I'd ever found before to do that was really in an Innotheker or a wine bar. And of course then you're consuming a glass at a time. And so I came across this place where you could sample all these wines and find what you like and purchase what you enjoyed and have it shipped home.
And, whereabouts in Tuscany?
It's in a place called Greve. It's still there. It's called La Cantina. Actually, it's called Innotheker Forlorni now. But it's right in the heart of Tuscany between Panzano and Castellina Panzano, Greve, and then you get to Strada. It's on the old road that goes between Florence and Siena. So it's pretty much right in the heart of Tuscany.
So, how is your wine knowledge 11 years later compared to what it was when you started?
Oh, not a great deal.
Not a great deal. You still go and taste that you like?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not here the entire time. I've owned the business, but I spend a lot of time in the enomatic business around Asia Pacific. But I still can find what I enjoy, and the staff know what I like and point me in the right direction. But, you know, we enjoy coming in here just like everybody else and grabbing a card and taking some time. And
so then how do you choose the wines? If your background is not wine and you're not here all the time, how do you determine what's on the machines and what's on the shelves?
Well, we sit down with the staff and we do a fair bit of blind tasting, something we're starting to do more of. We look to try and cover all different styles, regions and price points, so that people who want to try, you know, from the sub-regions of Central Otago, we have something to present to them. We're always looking for good wine. It certainly sells just as well. If we put a bad wine in, it's just, you know, it doesn't sell. People might try it, but it just doesn't correlate to sales as well. One of the other issues that we've been working through recently is margin. We're a fine wine retailer, and New Zealand has become dominated in retail by supermarkets and their associated chains. Australia is very much the same.
Yes.
And so one of the things we've been dealing with recently is that the margins we're being presented with to the producers, the wineries, the distributors are suggesting we sell their product for are at margin levels that are really only suitable for supermarkets or big box where there is no service. We have 8 very well trained staff. And the cost of business aren't the same as a supermarket. And so one of the things we've been working through is, you know, getting alignment with understanding where people, New Zealand premium wine is being positioned and how it's being presented to the consumer.
So do you do much travelling through New Zealand to look at those smaller, independent, perhaps not big cellar doors, but small little winemakers to try and find something that gives you a point of difference that the supermarkets are either not interested in or can't access?
Yes, there's definitely that aspect to it. Absolutely, we enjoy finding things and we can help build a brand because people can, you know, this is the cellar door for a number of those, including, you know, even still in Central Otago. Sometimes those smaller producers are sometimes the least commercially aware of the realities of taking a product to market. And you know, we do find the same issues there where they just really think that, you know, they can sell it for $25 at the cellar door and we can pay them $23 for it and present it to the world. Well, it's just not the reality.
It doesn't quite work like that because you can't pay staff wages on $2 out of a bottle of wine.
No, but I can certainly show you plenty of examples of producers who think because try to present to us, they walk in the door and fall over themselves wanting us to take their wines. They, you know, they want to be here, but unless there's some business to be done with it, it's impossible.
What's the most unusual product you've got in the space? I'm looking at whiskey and some of the international red wines and spirits and stuff. What's the most unusual thing we ought to taste while we're here?
Ooh, look, we have some sherries and some ports and Clearview Sea Red, a dessert red wine, probably more unusual. Maybe in Australia you've seen a few of those with sipplets and their sort of products. Juan, what's the most unusual wine we have here?
Or drink. It doesn't have to be wine.
New Zealand whiskey?
Yeah.
New Zealand whiskey. I think we should taste New Zealand whiskey.
Yep. That's proved very popular. And again, you know, people often don't know the story. So our team explained the story behind New Zealand whiskey. It's starting to sell out now. So it's coming to a bit of an end. But I think some of it's particularly good.
Is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
I'm standing in the kitchen of a restaurant just outside of Blenheim in Marlborough, New Zealand, talking to a young man by the name of Bradley Hornby. He and his wife have this restaurant called Arbor, and I think it's probably going to go down as one of the best meals I've had in maybe a decade. Bradley, tell me about where you've come from to get to this point.
I was born on the west, born and grew up on the west coast of the South Island, mm-hmm. and then worked at the Intercontinental Hotel in Wellington, and kind of learned the background of what I know, and then met Liz, and we travelled to Australia. We lived in the Great Barrier Reef on a place called Lizard Island,
yep.
and then we went over to Western Australia, where we had a couple of winery restaurants that we ran over there, and then we came back to New Zealand, where we before that, I spent some time at Hooker Lodge before going to Australia. And then we basically came back and set up a luxury accommodation venue called Annandale, which is in Banks Peninsula. And we've been saving for a restaurant pretty much for a whole decade. We've been together for 10 years, and we've just been saving as much as we could to get to where we wanted to go. So we luckily came across the jobs here, and the opportunity to buy into it came up. So
you're probably, I don't know, maybe 10 kilometres from the centre of Blenheim.
Yes, sir.
In Marlborough.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the places in the world you could choose with your talent, why here?
Well, we love Marlborough because it's, you know, similar to Western Australia in a lot of ways. It's different from a rural point of view because good wine always has the opportunity to have good food. So what we wanted to do was draw the similarities in terms of Western Australia, where we could do what we wanted to do in terms of food and service, but live in a rural setting. So Marlborough's a really interesting place in terms of it's great that it's rural, but we also have the ability to do what we learnt how to do. And we just wanted to come back to New Zealand, you know. We've been away for 7 or 8 years, and we just wanted to move home, really. And yeah.
So talk to me about the produce you can find around here. Let's wild venison, or you've actually got some farm venison that we've eaten tonight.
Yeah.
You have access to pigs and sheep. And how incredible is the produce you get to work with? How much of that informs what you do?
Oh, it's everything. And, you know, I think hopefully as time goes on, our circle will get smaller and smaller as we meet more passionate producers. So Cloudy Bay Clams, for instance, you know, they're a leader in terms of worldwide for their clams, you know. So we're lucky enough that they're right here and we get to deal with them personally. So, you know, all the different types of wild clams that we can get our hands on. We're really, really lucky in that we have a really, really passionate butcher who, nowadays, he still deals in whole carcass, which is great. And we're trying to make our circle smaller so that, you know, we want to get to the point where we know exactly kind of what farm the pigs came from, where the lambs are coming from. And even at the moment, you'll notice that there's a lot of hoggets grazing in the vineyards. That's our next step, is to get, for instance, lamb from Dog Point, lamb from Te Wharira, or, you know, and kind of tell the story like that. As far as vegetables and stuff like that goes, we're trying to implement our plan this year to our next-door neighbour, Grey Wacky, Kevin Judd. He actually plants vegetables and herbs and stuff for us, which is amazing. And then we've also got a plot down the road that we're... I mean, what we're trying to do is we're trying to make this business work financially first, so that in a couple of years' time we kind of don't have to watch our dream fall apart because we can't afford to run it. So this is early days for us in terms of implementing these things in stages, but there's lots and lots of wild stuff around. It's just about trying to find the time to actually get out there and do it and still have time to work as well. So
Liz was speaking to us outside before as we were having dinner. You've got a man that drops off a hat full of quinces or mushrooms. That, I guess, is the joy of working in a rural setting. But
yeah,
your food is at the standard of some of the best restaurants in the country, in fact, probably in the region.
Wow.
And I know that you don't do very well with praise, but it's quite alarming almost to find in this space. It was the last place I expected to find food of this quality.
Thank you.
What drives that little desire for perfection?
being crazy, probably. I think for us now, it actually means a lot more than it ever did, because this is like welcoming people into our own place, you know. So we try to give as much as we can, and the older I get, the more thoughtful I get in terms of trying to simplify things and trying to focus more on actually what I'd like to eat, rather than is this cool and edgy, and is this like the stuff I've seen on Twitter, or is this actually what somebody who's travelling here is going to eat? They're going to have enough to eat, and they're going to see good value for money, you know. And that translates right across from, you know, from the most basic sort of cheap restaurant right up to the $10,000 a night property. Everybody has their perception of what value for money is, so that's probably what drives us. And more, like I said, you know, I'm inspired by the winemakers and the viticulturalists and the people of the wine industry, because they can take a product that tastes of an area and do something very, very simple on face value, but extremely complicated. And that's really what inspires me, is that they're doing this with one product. We have millions of products, so I can rein it in and kind of say, you know, lamb with mint sauce and smoke roasted kumara, you know, that has a connection to me. Or the dish from my grandma too, you know, that has a direct connection, that it's probably not until now we can really start to do that, you know, and just kind of be who you are, you know.
Have you taken a big risk coming here to this particular space, or did it make really good sense to be here where you are, surrounded by some of the finest winemakers in New Zealand?
Yeah.
I would suggest it would be a risk, but you're probably going to argue with me.
No, I'm not. It's a huge risk, especially being right on the, you know, like you say, we're 10 minutes away from the centre of town. We're always thankful for when people can make the journey out to the restaurant. We're lucky in that we're in a really, really awesome... Our neighbours are amazing and they're inspirational. Financially, this is a massive risk, you know, because making ends meet, we've spent our whole career in the restaurant game, and, you know, we watch every penny we have, and we're thankful that on a night like tonight, on a Wednesday, you come and do many, because you actually pay for our power and everything else tonight, so... Yeah.
You told me before, as you get older, you'd be barely into your 30s, I would imagine.
34. How old are you, Mark? 34. Yeah, I'm 34.
Yeah, so you're all still kids as far as I'm concerned. and yet you have a maturity in your food. Talk to me through some of the things you use. This black garlic at the moment is... it's something we've seen a lot of through this week, and we're completely addicted to it.
Yeah.
Those sort of quirky things that you can find here, how much do they define the way you think about food in the region?
Well, black garlic is something that it's been really, really trendy for probably a couple of years now. But once we learnt the backstory of that, it's a product that comes from just up the road, and also Marlborough before grapes were kind of really took off. It was really well known for shallots, garlic and onions too, so... That's a big part of it. For us, flavour always comes first. So, you know, the black garlic, for instance, I just love the kind of umami notes it brings, but it's the funkiness of a salted black bean. It does the same thing that does to Asian culture. And, you know, like, as far as influence goes, in terms of... I started to look at European cooking and European cooking versus Asian cooking, and how not necessarily... ingredients, but how techniques can influence the food. So, you know, we learned how to cook at a polytech, where you learn you cook your stocks for days, and you cook
and then to make a bechamel sauce, and everybody's
cook the shit blah, out blah, of blah, this. Blah, blah, blah. And you kind of go completely the opposite when you look at a lot of, especially Southeast Asian food. And this is what I'm thankful for living in Western Australia for, because we had the opportunity to work with lots of people from Indonesia and Singapore and Malaysia and stuff. But you learn that, especially even in Chinese cookery, a lot of these things are really hard and really fast. And what that does is it packs that flavour into stuff. So we kind of look at things like that. Acids are a huge thing as well. If something's particularly fatty, we always try and balance it. But we're always looking for the different thing that... For instance, Phil and I today were down at our garden, or the garden that our friend has, and we're kind of talking about the different stuff that we need to get our program online of what we can be preserving and what we can be putting away for next year, you know, so that once we build that base, it's like committing to growing our own vegetables. We have to have a program so that we can do this forever, not just for a year and say, oh, shit, we can't afford to do this anymore. This, it's costing us twice as much, you know. So our area inspires us hugely.
If you had to point to somebody around the world that is the influence for the way you think about food and the way you prepare it, is there somebody that may be in our general psyche that is an influence to you?
In New Zealand, it would be Michael Meredith. Matt Lambert from the Musket Room. He's had the pleasure of meeting him. Ben Shuri is probably one of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life.
And I have to say, knowing Ben as well as I do, and Ben's food, there is a wonderful correlation in the way you put food on a plate with Ben. So he's an incredible chef, but I think you're very close.
Wow. Holy crap. And we had the pleasure of Ben coming here. He did a thing for Cloudy Bay called Forage, and we're lucky enough that he came in for dinner, and I volunteered just to, as anybody in their right mind would, just to hopefully work for the day with him, or the couple of days following that, and that completely changed the way that I look at food. But also, he completely redefines the thing about having an ego. You can have a presence, and you can be thoughtful, and you can have an opinion without coming across as being like one of the greatest chefs in the world, which he is.
He's one of the humblest chefs I've ever met from that point of view.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted you're inspired by him.
Thanks. Yeah, he's amazing.
I'll have to speak to him when I get back and find out how he thinks about you. Because I
want to sort of, I'm trying to paint a picture for the listener that the quality of food in this venue, in this place, 10 kilometres from a town of 35,000 people in a little wine district in New Zealand, is probably of the quality and of the vigour and the imagination of what Ben Shuri is serving in Attica.
Jesus Christ.
Well, that's, no, it's not his fault.
I think about what we're doing now, and for the first time in my life, I can actually see a path to the final product in terms of, you know, as a chef, you're always kind of tormented in a lot of ways that you're never happy with anything. And that's, in a lot of ways, that's really bittersweet, because it's amazing. And right now is a point when you really enjoy that. Or after cooking dinner for Ben Shuri and then giving him a ride home because his taxi didn't turn up. You know, like, it's stuff like that that makes it all worthwhile. So thank you very much.
Well, look, thank you for your time. I'm going to let you serve, I think, seventh or eighth course. I don't know which one we're up to, but a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
As the two Ronnies used to say, that's it from me and that's it from him. It's been a pleasure having your company again this beautiful Saturday afternoon. It's not so beautiful. It's a bit grubby, really. Thanks for joining me. It's been a joy to have your company, and I look forward to having you back next week. I'm taking you to the Escape Pod now with Russ, Joe and Mark. They're taking you travelling, as always, after 2 o'clock. And stay with us all afternoon right here on your favourite radio station, Joy 94.9. I've been Pete Dillon. This has been Cravings. Thanks for your company. It's 2 o'clock.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.